Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be in Toronto. This is my first visit to the University of Toronto, and so I'm enjoying the campus very much. I'm going to talk today about half of what I do, the superconductive device side of it. Along the way, you'll see some of the nanofabrication work. But if anyone here has a great love for nanofabrication, please come back, come afterwards and introduce yourself, and I'd really like to meet you and chat some more. I got into the superconductive nanowires actually when I came down to campus from Lincoln Laboratory in 2003. Our interest in them has actually continued with a connection to Lincoln Laboratory. So all the work I'm going to be talking about is in collaboration with Lincoln Laboratory, and especially with Jamie Kerman there, Brian Robinson, and Richard Molnar, and the group of Scott Hamilton. And also now, a lot of it is in collaboration with NIST, and I'll get to that as I get towards the end of the talk. So let me start out with a pretty picture. Does anyone know what this is a picture of? Do I say it up there? Mercury, thank you. Okay. So it's a picture of Mercury, and this just came out in the early October from the Messenger mission to Mercury. And the point of this picture actually has nothing to do with the content of this picture, but the number of pixels in the picture is the point I want to make. And that is that when people send probes to other planets, they heavily instrument those probes in order to bring back data and to analyze it. And in this case, this probe has two very nice cameras on it, has a set of spectrometers, magnetometer on it. It just did a flyby of Mercury. It's going to orbit Mercury shortly, and it's going to have an average communication rate with Earth of 15 megabytes per day. Okay, so you have to imagine this scientific laboratory generating huge amounts of data, orbiting a planet, this entire planet that we have here filled with scientists who would love nothing more than to analyze that data, and a straw connecting the two, sucking data through at an incredibly painfully low rate. In fact, the data at certain points in time drops to 10 bits per second. Okay, I'm going to talk about some technology that we hope will change that. The basic problem is diffraction. So these probes carry RF antennas. They try to push the RF to as high frequency as possible to get as short a wavelength as possible to limit diffraction. But the diffraction is still expanding, to fill planetary size diffraction spots. With the alternative is to use optical communication. Okay, in our case, we're interested in optical communication 1.55 micron. And this is in particular, the Lincoln Laboratory group that we collaborate with has studied this very closely as part of a Mars communication mission that was actually canceled, but did a system study of it. What they basically found is, along the way from Mars to Earth, you have 120 decibels, so that's 12 orders of magnitude of attenuation in the signal. So you start with a very powerful laser, well, as powerful as you can afford to fly, you're down to single photon levels of laser intensity when you get to Earth. And so to be able to take an optical signal and turn it into a viable communication stream on Earth, you need single photon sensitivity in your receiver. And so that is exactly the problem that we've been working on. Now, I'll just take a very quick aside and mention the communication scheme that they use, because it's so efficient and so clever. It's not something that I invented or even they invented. It's a well-known scheme from communication theory, but I just thought it was so neat that I'd mention it. And it's called pulse position modulation. And the basic idea is you want to communicate a signal to someone. So you take a piece of paper out, and maybe you write something down on it, and then you hand it to the person. And the information that you've transmitted is not what you wrote on the piece of paper, but the time of day at which you handed it to them. Okay, so you take that and you get several bits of information based on that. So that's how pulse position modulation encoding is. So if you have a very power-starved situation, so you want to try to transmit a lot of information with just a few photons, a good way to do that is to set up time as a set of slots. And the time of arrival of that single photon is going to indicate the information. So in this case, we give you an example of 4 bits per word, okay? So there's 16 time slots, and then it repeats. So a photon arrives, and you say, oh, based on that time of arrival, I'm going to take these 4 bits and put them down here. And based on the time of arrival over here, I'm going to take the next 4 bits and put them there. Okay, so very clever, very power-efficient way to communicate in situations where bandwidth is inexpensive, but power is very, very costly and hard to get. Okay, to give you a sense of the challenge of this problem of detecting single photons, you know, I can talk about billions of miles and kilometers, and I can talk about planets, but to give you, put it down to Earth, if you take a laptop at 100 kilometers, a single pixel on that laptop generates enough light to get one photon through your eye pupil per second, okay? So that's the sort of quantity of light that we're trying to get at. And what's particularly difficult about sensing single photons is the energy scales involved, and it gets worse as you go to the infrared. Now, for reasons having largely to do with the convenience of getting optical components at 1.5 microns, it actually makes a lot of sense to do all of this communication at 1.5 microns. But it's very difficult to sense the photons at 1.5 microns. And so that's what leads to the problem. We can't just use standard silicon devices for photon sensing. So what we use instead is this nanowire single photon detector. So these photon detectors, the first thing that actually kind of looked like this and counted single photons was invented by Gregory Goltzman. There's some work there going back to Alan Kaden in the mid-90s that was relevant. But we got into this at around 2003 trying to push the performance of these devices up to a level where it could be practically used in systems. The basic configuration is 2 electrodes. You run current between the electrodes. And this, I've just highlighted the nanowire portion of it back and forth. It's about a 90 nanometer wide wire, and it has about a 3 micron by 3 micron square pattern. And this particular pattern is called does anyone know what you call that pattern? Raster pattern, that's a good name for it. There's the lithographers have this special word for it that I think only lithographers ever use. It's like a secret word, so I'm going to tell you all this word. It's called boustrophedonic. So boustrophedonic refers to, it's derived from talking about how a cow would plow a field. So an ox drags the pattern back and forth like this across the field. So a very small plow, very small. You know that nano bull picture that was in Science a long time ago? It might be able to drag a plow across this field. So, when we made this, we were quite proud of having made a single photon detector. And then we looked into human biology a little bit and realized that we hadn't done something quite as remarkable as what we thought, because actually you all have single photon detectors in a manner of speaking. So the eye is actually capable of converting single photons into electrical signals, which elsewhere in the body would be sensed. Okay, your eye actually does not sense the single photon. So if you dark adjust your eye, you sit in a room, and you put a flash of a single photon, your retinal cells will be firing, they will be generating currents, but those currents will not be perceived by your optical system as a flash of light until you get to about 10 photons. And the reason for that, the reason your body does that, your optical system does that, is shot noise. So if you were able to sense single photon level in a low light situation, say you're hunting or something like that in the middle of the night, or say you're tweaking your optics in the middle of the night, maybe a little more realistic. You would see a sort of a flicker from the shot noise, and it would be very distracting. So your body puts a threshold at about 10 photons, okay? And that's what it requires in order to fire a signal down your optical nerve. So that's the one thing it does. It does some electrical, not every photon that's absorbed gets detected. The other thing that happens is actually if you turn and you stare into the eyes of the person next to you, I don't know if you would feel comfortable doing that in this setting, but you'll see that your eye actually has a lot of reflection off of its surface, and that's wasted light, okay? The lens of your eye also has reflection from it. This is not very accurately drawn. Of course, the image is formed across the whole retina, but this is just a general idea. Your pupil limits the amount of light letting your eye. And then finally, you actually get a substantial amount of light that just goes right through your retina and just illuminates your brain directly. So a certain amount of this talk is being transmitted directly into your brain. So. You have about 200 photons incident on the cornea to get a pulse visible on the retina. So that gives you a sense of the optical loss that happens along the path here. And so why am I telling you all this? Because actually, this system mimics very precisely the design of our photodetectors. Okay, so, and this was not deliberate. We discovered this afterwards. So, this is intelligent design. This is evolution. As of Tuesday, I'm allowed to say that now. So, the light comes in from the back surface. You have a sapphire substrate. We actually use an anti-reflection coating, so that actually is one where we've improved slightly on nature's design because we don't have that reflection from the very front surface of our eye. Our retina is right here. It's a niobium nitride thin film that I showed you the picture of earlier, but this is a cross-section now, schematic cross-section. And then right here you have something that we added, a little extra, to give us some enhancement. The mirror retroreflects the light and goes back into the nanowire to give you a second pass. So the light that went through the nanowires is sort of the light transmitted to the brain, but we actually send it back through the nanowires to give us a second pass. And we actually use interference to actually build up that signal and give a substantial amount of absorption in that system. And we thought, well, okay, you know, it's close to the eye, but it's not, you know, that close because we use interference and we're physicists and so we're, you know, clever about such things. And then we discovered that the cat's eye, it turns out, has at the back of it a distributed Bragg reflector in which there are certain cells and their only purpose in life is to have a quarter wavelength width so that small reflections from layers of these cells build up constructively to give you a large retroreflection back into the retina. Okay, so, nature beat us there. And this is where it goes. It goes right on the back of the device to just enhance it. And that's why cats have eye shine, which is why cats in the middle of the night, if you look at their eyes, you see that light coming back. It's coming off of that distributed Bragg reflector. Okay, so there's a couple of things about the human eye that are not very desirable for our purposes. One is it's very slow. Second of all, it requires expensive packaging. and it has too low efficiency. So 200 photons in for one count is not acceptable to the applications that we need. So let me talk about some of the metrics. And I should mention that there is really a long list of metrics that you use when you talk about single photon detection, and I'm just highlighting a few of the few that I really care the most about, not all of them here. So for instance, here you have efficiency. So when a single photon comes in, this is a very schematic picture of a photon, then a voltage pulse should always come out, but sometimes this happens and you miss the photon, no voltage pulse is generated. So that's bad. So we want every photon in to give us a voltage pulse. Secondly, we want to have very short what's called reset time. So, you know, if two photons hit this detector in close sequence, we want the detector to be able to realize that those were two separate events. But what in fact happens in many detectors is the presence of the previous photon temporarily blinds the detector against the detection of a second photon. And this actually happens in your eye. If you stare at certain colors of light, your cones get bleached, and then you look sideways, and then you see the complementary color momentarily. Probably if you look at the blue and then you look over there, you'll see the red. I don't know if it works, but. And then finally, the jitter, or not finally, the jitter is a case where there's always a slight electrical delay between when the photon arrives and when you register the voltage pulse coming out. And so you can imagine that that's a real problem if you're in this time-sequenced, time-synchronized communication scheme where your voltage pulse doesn't always correspond exactly to when the photon arrived. It's also a lot of problem for other applications. One potential application is laser radar. In that case, you send out a laser pulse, the light bounces off the scene, and you measure the distance to an object by the time of retroreflection. But if there's jitter in the retroreflected signal, then you're not going to know exactly when you got it back, so you're not going to know how far away the object was. Okay? So jitter is a key parameter for a number of applications. And then finally, dark counts. Now, this seems, you know, sort of odd, but you can actually get a situation where a voltage pulse is generated even though no photon was incident. Okay? And this can be generated just from thermal fluctuations inside the device. It's also possible, and in our case, the dominant situation, that a very low level of background infrared that's generated by blackbody radiation of just objects that are around the detector can actually create a voltage pulse. So these dark counts are undesirable because they mislead you about the signal that you're detecting. So just to hit those key parameters for our detectors before we go into sort of how they work and all of that, why we're interested is the detectors have remarkable performance on all of these metrics simultaneously. So for instance, in detection efficiency, I'll start down here, you're looking at detection efficiencies in the infrared in the 50, 60, 70% range. Reset times, this is the time, the blocking time, this device is reset in about 3 nanoseconds. The jitter is about 30 picoseconds, which corresponds to a transmission distance of light of about 1 centimeter. Okay, so that's the uncertainty with which you know where the time of arrival. And then the background counts, and this is, I should emphasize again, limited by background, not intrinsic to the device, but by infrared background that's present, is at about 2.4 thousand counts per second. So, how does this compare to other detectors? Well, other detectors generally have very strong performance in at least one of these metrics. So, for instance, avalanche photodiodes that you may be familiar with can have very good detect device efficiency and also solid performance in the jitter, about 200 picosecond, 100 picosecond jitter performance, but suffer when it comes to reset time. Similarly, photomultipliers, very good reset time, but in the infrared, suffer from low efficiency. So what the detectors, one of the reasons these detectors are so attractive is because they kind of span a range of high-performance metrics. So if you have a challenging system application, this is a good choice. Some of the other applications that I'm not going to go into in a lot is VLSI device evaluation. Transistors emit infrared photons when they switch, so you can actually image infrared. You can image transistor circuits real time. Laser radar, I mentioned already. In communication, there's quantum communication where people try to use single photons for very high data rate, high security communication, and interplanetary communication, which is the one that I described at the start. So we're going to focus on these two characteristics, mostly because these are the two where we've developed the highest understanding at this point, and these two we're still, we get the performance, but not fully understood why exactly and what feeds into it. So how do the devices work? You have a superconductor, it's actually a very robust state of matter. You think of it as being fragile because it occurs at low temperature, but then we just cool to a lower temperature, in which case it's a very robust state. You can shine light on it, nothing happens. But a superconductor can be made more fragile by either putting a lot of current into it, putting it in a high magnetic field, or raising its temperature to just below its critical temperature. And so just from a simplicity point of view, it's easiest to just pass the current through it. So what we do is this is an IV characteristic, we bias the nanowire up to a critical current very close to a current very close to the critical current. So at this point, about 97.5% of the switching current, where if we went any higher, it would just turn into a metal wire. Okay. And at this point, we just leave the bias current right there and wait. And at that point, if a single photon, even an infrared photon, hits the nanowire, It generates a cascade of events, which I'm going to go through very quickly, but I'd be happy to answer questions in more detail later if people have them. You start with bias current, photon is absorbed, current is diverted, which leads to increased current density locally on either side. That current density exceeds the critical current density. The device then has a normal region, meaning a resistive region that spans across it. And then you have a large inductance in the device, and therefore a current cannot change instantly. Current continues to drive through this resistor and causes Joule heating, which expands that resistive region. So this is a sort of secondary or an amplifying effect. And then at that point, the current does eventually redistribute into the amplifier, and that's when you see a voltage pulse. Okay, that current starts going into the amplifier. Once the current is all the way in the amplifier, you've got a nice strong voltage on your amplifier, but you have no current in your device. That's good, because now the device is free to relax back into the superconducting state, which you need in order to be able to detect the second photon. So the system superconducts now, the resistance disappears, and actually this is what limits the time scale of operation, is the current has to go from this amplifier load resistor back into the detector, and it's a first order L over R circuit. It has an L over R time constant. Okay, and you would think, well, it's a few micron scale device, so its inductance can't be that much. Unfortunately, superconductors have this thing called kinetic inductance. Actually, all metals have kinetic inductance, but most metals don't. You don't see it until optical frequencies or very high RF frequencies. In superconductors, you see it at a DC. So there's no magnetic fields here, but there's a huge inductance associated with the kinetic energy of the charge carriers. And that's what we learned, took us a couple years, about 2005, 2006, we learned that that was the key limiter of the speed of these devices. So you have here, finally, a reset. And that's about a 1 nanosecond reset time. And so it takes a few of those reset times you can reset the device. We make the device, as I mentioned, in the nanostructures lab at MIT. It's a six-layer process, lithography steps. I think there's 4 or 5 lithography steps along the way. Most of it is e-beam lithography. So we start with material that we actually get from our collaborators. So in the past, we've always got material from Gregory Goltzman's group at the Moscow State Pedagogical University. And now, more recently, we got very nice material from Lincoln Laboratory. So this is the starting material. We do the nanopatterning in our laboratory with electron beam lithography. We use this spin-on glass resist, which is called hydrogen silsesquioxane. And it's a very convenient material because after you expose it as an electron beam resist, you can anneal it, turns into silica or silicon dioxide. And then you can just leave it on your substrate as an active optical material, as a passive optical material. You also then use the same material for the anti-reflection coating. It turns out it's impedance matched perfectly for going between air and sapphire. So it has an index right at the right range. And it can be spin cast to with 1 nanometer precision. So it's a very simple way to put on these anti-reflection layers. This is upside down from what I showed you earlier. So just to remind you, the light is now going to come in from this side. Okay. So this doesn't have a cavity on it. I mentioned that we put cavities on it. We do that in subsequent processing steps. We, again, deposit the hydrogen silsesquioxane. And this layer now we pattern with electron beam lithography, somewhat larger so that it's well outside the device region. And then here we put, by liftoff, a metal mirror on the top surface. And finally, we put the anti-reflection coating on the bottom. I will mention, I'm not going to go through all the details of the electron beam lithography, but I will mention that you have to control the width of the device quite precisely. If there's a narrowing anywhere along the device, you get a reduction in the critical current. And that means that you have to bias it down at the critical current of that narrowest spot. And so the rest of your device is now not near its transition, and therefore it's not sensitive. So across these devices, sort of 10 micron by 10 micron, so this is about a half a millimeter long nanowire, 100 nanometers wide, we're able to control the line width to plus or minus 2.5 nanometers. Okay, so there's a lot of just sort of engineering that goes into that. This is the final chip. We make about 500 devices per chip, and we probe it. I apologize here for the American quarter. I can assure you, no matter what the exchange rate, this is the same size as a Canadian quarter. So you know what scale this is on. And I should mention that our collaborators at Lincoln Laboratory have a cryogenic probing station. We actually have one too. Very useful devices that allow us to probe large, large numbers of devices. So I think the first chip we made, we tested more devices than had probably been tested in the entire previous history of the field. So because cryogenic testing is so laborious in terms of mounting, packaging, cooling, and so forth, having this cryogenic probing ability is really instrumental. So let me talk now about the reset time a little bit, just to remind you, this is the problem where a second photon comes in, but you don't see it because the device was being switched. So this is a characteristic trace. Here's where the hot spot suddenly forms. You get the Joule heating in this region. The device eventually relaxes into the normal state as the current is diverted into the amplifier. So the reason you're seeing a voltage here is because the current is in the amplifier at that moment. It's actually in the transmission line to the amplifier. And then you see an L over R type relaxation as the current is restored. The point being that as you're going here, there's actually zero current in the device. So there's no way that device is going to sense a photon. And even when you're almost all the way back, okay, you're still only at 90% of the initial current, which is not good enough to get a good biasing condition. So you really have to wait until the current is completely restored before you get. So this is just schematically two pulses with a short delay. The device current is not fully restored, and therefore the detection efficiency is greatly lowered in this region. Okay. Some of the electrical dynamics of this, I mentioned that there's a big problem with kinetic inductance in these devices, slowing the device down. So you might ask, well, what's limiting you to such a large kinetic inductance? And the reason that's necessary is you need a large area device. It's like the pupil of the eye. The device is the pupil of you, is your pupil. And if you make it too small, you're not going to get enough light into it. Okay, so you need to have a large area device. If you have a large area device, you have a lot of carriers of energy, a lot of Cooper pairs. These are the carriers of superconductive charge and current, and therefore you're going to have a lot of kinetic inductance. So there's no way to really trivially lower this kinetic inductance. So what we can do instead is we can add an extra resistance. The time constant is L over R, so we just increase the resistance, the only downside being it requires additional lithography. So we have to add to this process a process of lift-off of titanium resistors, which give you a good resistance control there. And the device goes right at this spot here. Okay. This is the 50-ohm probing station that you do it there. And indeed, this works as you would expect without the resistor in there. You get, in this case, a time constant for that particular device was something like 30 nanoseconds, and it was reduced by about a factor of 5 by adding, I think, a 250-ohm or 300-ohm resistor in series. The only problem with this is when we do the same thing with a 3-nanosecond device. So we try to accelerate a 3-nanosecond device to an even faster performance, say 100 picoseconds or something like that. What happens is you start to exceed the thermal time constants of the device. So the device, instead of resetting, it basically the current resets before the system cools, and now you have a situation where you're basically biasing a normal device. And if you're just biasing a normal device, you just end up in a metallic state. So it turns out that because the thermal system is, and I'm not going to, maybe I shouldn't even go into it any more beyond that. But basically, even though we can go to large areas and we can get some improvement in the reset time, we're not able to get down to reset times of the 1 nanosecond time scale. I will mention, you'll see a little bit of a dip here below, and that's because the signal is AC coupled. So you know, it doesn't look like a perfect L over R time constant because there can be no net DC current passing. Okay, so let me now talk more about, so that's all the discussion I'm going to make of electronics at this point, I believe. I'm going to talk now more about efficiency and optics. I showed you this earlier. This is detection efficiency versus bias current. And as you get close to the ideal bias current, your detection efficiency gets close to optimal. Detection efficiency has three components. The first is sort of the pupil side of it. It's the active area. How large an area can you couple to? The second is absorptance. So this is sort of the process of getting the light into our retina, if you will. And then finally, the probability of resistive state formation. So this is the optical nerve here that's saying, okay, when a photon is absorbed by the retina, do you necessarily get an electrical signal? Or sometimes could you get an absorbed photon and no electrical signal? Okay, so these three things can kind of happen here, and they're all bad. Okay, so if you get a no light absorbed, that's bad. If you get light missing the detector, et cetera. And what we can do, I'm going to start at the back, start over here and kind of move that way. So looking at the probability of resistive state formation, you can actually take the detection efficiency, which you measured, the coupling efficiency, which you know just because you know the area, the absorptance, which you can measure, and you can extract the probability of resistive state formation for any given device. And we've done that. Now, this is one of those graphs. If you're a graduate student in the audience, you might want to pay attention here. This is like 2.5 years of work to generate this graph. And you get like 15 seconds when your advisor presents the work. So let me just say that, you know, built a microscope, scanning microscope that could go to room temperature and low temperature to measure the absorptance, to normalize it to the detection efficiency, to extract the polarization resistance. So, at the end of the day, what we saw, and for a range of different devices, first of all, a very big difference in the absorptance as a function of polarization. And if you're familiar at all with wire grid polarizers, this will be no surprise to you at all. Because narrow metal wires are actually used as polarizers because electric fields that are polarized along the wire don't induce surface charge, okay, and therefore couple efficiently to the nanowires, whereas electric fields that are polarized orthogonal to the nanowire are screened by surface charges and therefore are absorbed less by the nanowire. Okay, so this is all we're seeing here, a difference in absorptance and a difference in detection efficiency, okay, that corresponds to that difference in absorptance. But the second thing you'll notice is that the probability of resistive state formation, which ranges from about 0.5 to 0.85 for the case of parallel polarization, only ranges from about 0.7 to about 0.35 for the orthogonal polarization. And this was a big puzzle to us, and we still aren't 100% sure of the answer here. But what we think is happening is that the nanowire, as I said, the parallel polarization, you have no screen charge, and therefore you have absorption evenly throughout the nanowire, across the cross-section of the nanowire. But in the orthogonal polarization, there's screen charge on the surface, therefore there's less light near the edges. And we think it's possible that the probability of resistive state formation may depend on where the photon is absorbed within the nanowire. So if it's absorbed at the edges, it just generates a hotspot of slightly larger cross-section relative to the wires. There's a simple geometric argument you could make that would argue that. And that may be responsible for this difference. So kind of an interesting nano-optics application here. Okay, so let me go back to these three keys to efficiency. I've talked already about enhancing the absorptance with the cavity that's integrated onto that device. I'm going to now go to the coupling efficiency. And the problem with coupling efficiency is just the fact we have to do all this in a doer. If we could do this at room temperature, it would be quite easy to focus that 1.5 micron light onto the spot. But we have to do it at low temperature. Everything has to be done via remote control. And it's just hard to get light into a fiber in a very high numerical aperture through the back of a sapphire wafer onto the device. So we're limited to our numerical aperture here of about 0.6. So that means that our spot size is somewhat larger than the 3-micron device that we typically make. So this is sort of what it looks like. That's our 3-micron device in green, and that's our spot in red. And we really don't want to be losing the light that misses that device. So what's the solution? Well, it's simple, right? You make a bigger device, right? But I mentioned earlier, the bigger the device, the higher the kinetic inductance, and so you're going to have a slower operation. So that's not very attractive. So the approach we take instead is subdivide the device into many sub-elements, each of which has the same area as you originally had. So each of these sub-elements has a 3-nanosecond reset time. So now you have a much more complicated readout, because you have to read out 10 devices independently, but you have very high speed. And so we're willing to take on complexity, but we're not willing to lose performance in this case. So we haven't gone all the way to 10 elements, my student Eric Dahler has made this device. It's a 4-element device. And if you remember, I said the original device was a booster phenonic pattern where an ox would plow a field back and forth. This pattern is sort of how an ox might drag a four-tined rake across a field, okay? So each tine of the rake is its own detector, and it goes down, and then it turns around, and then it comes back up, it turns around, it comes back down. And so you get this very highly intertwined pattern, so you can shine a single photon spot across a single optical mode across that entire pattern, get very even absorption across the pattern. The colors here, so you can follow the purple one here going back and forth intermittently with the others. Okay. So this gives us with this device then, integrated with a microcavity, we achieved a system detection efficiency of 46%. Okay, so that particular packaged device was demonstrated at Lincoln Laboratory using our device by Eric Dahler. So the thing we originally were doing this to get at speed and get at increased active area. But very quickly, we realized something interesting, which was we now had 4 channels. Each of them was photon counting detectors. And so we had inadvertently, by the time we got to the 4-element, we realized we were doing it on purpose. But we had made a photon number resolving detector. And I'll tell you how that works. So the basic idea is that if you have a pulse hitting the detector array, and let's say that pulse has exactly 2 photons in it, okay? You will never see 3 detectors fire, right? Unless there's a dark count event, but dark count events are rare. You will never see 3 detectors fire. So you can say something about the number of photons in the pulse if you see 2 or fewer detectors fire, okay? And in fact, if you see only 1 detector fire, you can conclude with some confidence that maybe there was only 1 photon in the pulse. It's possible the 2 photons hit the same detector, okay? But not very likely because there are 4 detectors, and so only 25% of the time would the second photon hit that same detector, okay? So you can kind of take this limitation of the number of detectors you have, knowledge of what Poisson statistics should tell you about the number of photons in pulses for different powers, and you can do a theory, and the solid lines are the theory, for whether you would see 0 counts, 1 count, 2 counts, 3 counts, or 4 counts as a function of the number of incident photons, number of absorbed photons in the detector. And when you do that, and then you do the experiment, you actually look at the statistics, the histograms of all of these two, they fit perfectly. So I've highlighted here a few particular examples. So this is about 1 photon absorbed per pulse. And what you see is in our detector, which is the green, a very good match between the photon statistics that we see in our detector and the true photon statistics that a perfect photon counter would be able to get. Now, obviously, when you get down here and you have a large number of photons, you know, we only have 4 detectors. So we can never count more than 4, okay? So we're not able to predict very accurately in that instance. But in instances where we have low numbers of photons, low incident optical powers, we can tell you about how many photons were in that pulse. Now, this is the photons absorbed, and so there's a normalization of detection efficiency. So I don't want to give the impression that we're all the way there. I think it's very important for these kinds of experiments to push up your detection efficiency so that you're looking at actually the photons from your source and not just the photons that arrive at the detector. But another thing that you can do in our detectors that's nice, I should mention, this photon counting can be done with other kinds of detectors. like, for instance, arrays of avalanche photodiodes. A number of groups have demonstrated nice photon counting in that situation, photon number resolution. But what you cannot do is you cannot do time resolution of that. So in this case, you could do 100 picosecond separation of two pulses and do photon number resolution of both of these. So it uses the full bandwidth of the detector to do this photon statistics. Sorry, to do this photon number resolution. I misspoke, but there was actually a little bit of a hint of what I was going to talk about next in that. So just to explain this, this is number of counts here. This is the time delay. And what you see is for the first pulse, you see one set of one histogram here. This has been binned at a higher level. And then the second count, the second pulse is also resolvable. OK, so photon statistics. So this is actually where I'm going to wrap up. So we are quite interested in now actually looking at the cases where multiple photons were detected and to try to pull out something sort of more surprising about the sources in those instances. So let me show you what you can do. Just a very brief reminder of photon statistics. I think, I don't know if like when I kind of got to this point in the experiment, we said, oh, we could probably do that. I had to kind of remind myself of the basics of quantum optics. So let me just do that for you now. So if you have a random stream of photons, that corresponds to a coherent source. Okay, so it's a little counterintuitive. A coherent source would be like a perfect sine wave. So you might expect the photons would kind of arrive right at the peaks of the sine wave. But in fact, that's not true. In fact, the perfect sine wave gives you perfectly random arrival of the photons. If you have a thermal source, the photons start to bunch. So the photons will tend to arrive at the same time preferentially. So if they see a given photon in a mode, they like to go into that mode. In a single photon source, where you have some kind of process of excitation and fluorescence, and there's some time associated with the excitation process, for instance, you get these anti-bunched patterns, which kind of look random, but there's too much space in between these for them to be really random. And you can look at the arrival probabilities of pairs, and you can see very different behavior for them, these characteristic bumps and dips. So one way you might hope to do this is to just take a photon counter and put it in a photon stream and just very, very, very high bandwidth see, okay, I counted a photon, now I counted another one, and look for them, looking for the photons to be very close together, which would be associated with this bunching, right? The problem is, from a practical point of view, these photodetectors take a long time to reset. And this is exactly the challenging problem from the reset perspective, where we're asking the detector to find two photons that are separated by picoseconds instead of nanoseconds, which is where they can do a decent job resetting. So just from a practical point of view, this approach is quite challenging, and you get very little information about that very short time scale separation that you care about the most. Another approach is to actually use two photodetectors, and this is the kind of standard method, Hembury-Brown twists and those kinds of experiments, where you correlate the arrival of signal from two separate channels, and because the beam splitter is here, you can then do a time correlation of the two signals and look for enhancement, and you can get out these peaks. So our approach is actually to take exactly this setup, and this setup has actually been done with these nanowire detectors from another group in the recent past. But our approach is actually to take this integrated array that we've developed of four elements and to shine the photon stream on just that individual detector. And now treat the fact that the single optical mode is spread out across several detectors as an effective beam splitter. Okay? So the photons are making the choice about, quote unquote, which way to go actually when they're on the detector itself, by choosing which detector they're going to be absorbed at, which is a completely random choice. So here you have, for instance, the array that we chose. This is a four-element array. There's another one out here. And the beam is spread out to cover a much larger area here. This work, I should mention, by the way, if I haven't already, is done in collaboration with NIST and, in fact, with a single photon source that they had at their facility there. So that gave us an opportunity to look at the photon statistics of various types of sources. So the way it's done is you take two pulses in short time sequence, and you look for correlation counts as a function of the time delay that you insert between the two detector channels. If you have a coherent source, you see something like this. If you have a single photon source, what you see, because the source is anti-bunched, it's very unlikely that within a single one of these pulses you get two photons, and therefore you only ever see one of those four detectors fire. Okay. And in fact, we've done this now. So this is the correlation counts. And what you see is a very narrow peak that is completely periodic with the periodicity of the pulsed laser that's being used to illuminate the system. The only difference with an avalanche photodiode, so this is our detector, the superconducting nanowire single photon detector. The only difference from the avalanche photodiode is the avalanche photodiode has more jitter, and therefore you get slightly wider peaks in the correlation measurement. When you do this with a quantum dot, now the quantum dot limits the jitter, so you don't see as much of a difference between this avalanche photodiode and our detector, but you can still see very clearly from our detector the suppression of the zero time separation. So that's the anti-bunching that's occurring. I should mention as well, this avalanche photodiode is not an integrated array. This is two avalanche photodiodes and a beam splitter. So it's quite a different setup in two cases. With a pseudo-thermal source, so you can generate that by just spinning a glass disk, shining light on it, you can get a G2 measurement. So this is the correlation peak that's showing a bunching effect. And it's the right magnitude, and it's what you would expect in this situation. So that's encouraging. But remember, we actually have four detectors, right? So this is answering the question, if there is a photon already in the beam, what's the added probability that a second photon will be in the beam, okay, or a second photon will be detected, okay? So now we can ask the question, if there are two photons in the beam, what's the probability that a third photon will be detected? And so instead of being G2 being 2, you actually expect a G3, okay, and it's being 6. And so this is it. These lines are the two-photon correlations. Okay, so this is what I showed you before, the G2 correlations for the various detectors. This is the 1 in the 2 detector, the 1 in the 3 detector, the 2 in the 3 detector. So we're taking 3 of the detectors here. And this is the complete coincidence point where all three of the detectors are aligned in time and lined up. So that's as far as it's gone. I think you can see where this is going, right? We've got 3, go to 4, maybe 5, you know. At a certain point, you know, you're sort of just doing an exercise in quantum optics. You know, what would be something you could do with this? And I think one of the interesting directions would be to try to characterize photon sources. So if someone, say, you know, gives you a photon source for quantum cryptography and says, oh, trust me, this is a single photon source, you know, well, you're going to encode all your secrets in this. You'd really like to look at that and prove to yourself that's a single photon source, right? And so with greater confidence with which you know the photon statistics, the greater with which you can verify that something fishy isn't happening with a source for that. So that's one area on which there might be interest. But if others have ideas, I think we had some interesting conversations today that actually suggested some possible applications of this. So there is a future, and I'll mention it very briefly. One is detection at longer wavelengths. So for that, you'd like to do narrower wires because longer wavelengths have less energy. A narrower wire is going to see less energy means a smaller hotspot generated, so you want a proportionally smaller wire. Hard to make, but we're able to make 10 nanometer wide wires, 30 nanometer pitch, winding back and forth. Too small, unfortunately, to measure at this point. So we're working on making measurements of them. Another possibility, integrating plasmonic structures. This can improve our coupling a little bit. So we had some conversations about trying to get to higher and higher efficiencies. And there's a structure that we've devised, a preprint coming out. You can send me an email if you're interested in a preprint on this. But basically, a gold retroreflector, but that has little gold sort of nano antennas that locally focus the light into the region where the niobium nitride is. So the niobium nitride is right in here. And so it's sort of actually very analogous to a super transmission effect in which you create plasmons on either side of the gold. And then a sort of a more engineering approach to this is to integrate the device into a waveguide. We actually very coincidentally are on the same hallway as a group that makes integrated optical waveguides. And through that interaction have come up with this design for a niobium nitride nanowire that would basically be the lossy element in an integrated optical waveguide. And with this, we think we could get to a very high absorption efficiencies. Because essentially, if you want more absorptance, you just propagate further along. And also, we could do it with a relatively small amount of area, and so get around a lot of the coupling efficiency problems that I mentioned earlier. So this is the first design that doesn't really look like an eye at all. It looks like something quite different, and be an interesting direction to go. So I think that's all I'll say, and I just want to acknowledge my collaborators once more at NIST, Lincoln Laboratory, and all of my students, especially Vikasanant, Eric Dollar, Joelle Yang, who have done most of this work. So thanks very much. You know, I never thought about it until you just said that, but bolometer is a really ugly word, isn't it? So I think you're right. I think it's a largely nano-quenching. One of the reasons that it's not coherent is because the energy of the photon is so large relative to the superconducting gap. So the right picture to have is actually of a hole being generated deep in the Fermi sea, a hot electron being generated well into the Fermi gas, and then you basically have relaxation to the top band edge of the superconducting state. And it's those quasiparticles in the top band edge of the superconducting state that suppress the superconductivity locally and lead to the generation of the hotspot. The idea of speeding it up by reducing thermal heat capacity, I think that it's a promising direction to look at thermal boundary resistance, say, because we do run into some thermal limits. But as I mentioned, we are more limited at this point by kinetic inductance. And so we can't do that to an arbitrary degree. And so it's not really a bolometer because it's never in thermal equilibrium. And that would be the key distinction I would draw between it and like one of the transition edge sensors, which is a true bolometric detector.
Would this kind of device be useful for people that do single molecule fluorescence in biophysics, that when you put this, the WebEx, you said that you prefer to do it invisible, but you went to 1,500 nanometers just because
right.
everything is there. Visible.
What I would say is that in the visible, there are competing technologies that I would probably, even as someone who loves this technology, I would choose the competitors just because, unless I really cared about jitter, you could usually sort of make do with an avalanche photodiode or a photomultiplier tube. It's really when you get in the infrared where you see that you just can't do anything close to this with another technology. Yeah. Right. So I have a suspicion that this is a field you know more about than I, so I'd love to talk to you about it afterwards.
Quick question about the die counts. You said those are the die counts because of the diagonal radius. Do you have an idea what that means?
So there are papers out there that address that issue. And I have not really surveyed that work. I tend to just believe it if we've measured it. You know, I mean, not that I think that it's wrong. I just haven't seen it ourselves yet. And so I don't, you know, so but there are reports of really low per second type of dark counts. And I do believe that if you were willing to sacrifice in other performance areas, you could reduce the dark counts further. I think that dark counts of the few per second have been reported. Yes, there's actually a paper by University of Delft group recently on exactly that topic, just came out. They used a spiral, I think. We actually looked at spirals a long time ago. You know, we run into this problem a lot. There's a lot you can do if you're willing to sacrifice some performance, okay? And we're always just trying to get the absolute best performance out of it. And so I think if you go to a spiral, by necessity, you're going to have some reduced efficiency. You're going to get no polarization dependence, but you're not going to have overall the same efficiency of the device. So, you know, I think there are designs. This coupler, the integrated coupler might do it too. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you care about polarization, then you might as well align it to be agreed with the detector. And if you don't care about polarization, then you can always, you know, let me think a little bit. If you have an unpolarized signal coming in, it's just not a problem that I've considered. What you would do with an unpolarized incident signal, because it's so rare from the applications, all the signals coming in are polarized that we've thought about. So I think that there would be solutions for an unpolarized signal. But.
What order of magnitude are your bias curves?
About 10 microamps, sorry. Yeah, I should have said that.
Very dull.
Well, depends on your perspective, yeah. I mean, in my previous life, I worked on superconductive quantum computing, and like you never had anything more than a microamp. So, you know, it's quite manageable. You can make a really very simple current bias box, very stable at that type of level. In fact, the problem we face going to 10 nanometer dimensions is getting really good biases that are stable at the 1 microamp level and trying to read out really small voltages that come out of those. So those are electrical problems that we have. It's very broadband. It starts to cut off. I mean, we've seen it through the visible, and I actually have a spectrum I can show you afterwards if you want. But, you know, the cavity is a very low Q cavity. It's just to give you a couple reflections of the signal. And so it has a bandwidth of hundreds of nanometers. And so, you know, there's a dip at around 900 nanometers, and then all through the visible it's pretty good. And I would expect that it would work all the way through the UV and then stop working once you start to get well into the X-ray and there's less absorption in the film. And then in the infrared side, We've not looked at it out past 1.5 microns, but I would expect it would start to roll off badly at for these devices out at 2 microns and above.
One more question?
There's one.
Oh. You mentioned that as an end, you actually use the wire of light, and that's a bad thing.
It's a bad thing? Oh, yeah. So the reason it's a bad thing, I mean, the cut out of the side of the wire, if you did that systematically, sort of trimmed the whole wire down using an overetch or something like that, that could be a good thing and give you a little more sensitivity. But if the problem comes in when it's local, when there's just one little dent at one little point, because it improves your efficiency at that point, okay? But now you had to lower your bias current so that you could get the bias current through that one point. And so everywhere else in the device, you're not properly biased now. So that's why it's a problem.
All right, we